This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
When rock and roll emerged in 1955 and 56, Bob Dylan was 14 or 15 years old. His birth was perfectly timed to get the full force of Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly. Who better than a teenager to take notice, to be influenced, and to have the time and energy to really listen and learn? In today's episode, we dive into exactly what Bob Dylan likely heard and how it appears to have showed up in his later work. We're discussing Bob Dylan and rock music, continuing our walk through one of the most celebrated of all Bob Dylan books, Song and Dance Man, with its author, Michael Gray. Today, we're looking at Chapter 3, which is called Bob Dylan and Rock Music. In earlier episodes, we discussed Chapters 1 and 2 and learned how Dylan learned from and used folk music and then the world of literature. In each, we've been shown clearly how Bob was influenced, by whom, and what he did with what he read and heard. And today we'll learn those same lessons about how a young Robert Zimmerman took what he heard on his AM radio in Hibbing, Minnesota, and used it to become the force we know as Bob Dylan. One small example. Did you know that the way Bob stretches and bends words to make rhymes that would otherwise not be there was a technique that he first heard from Fats Domino? I didn't. But Michael walks us through the history of popular music at the time in a way that tells us what is, I think, an interesting new story about the formative years of Bob Dylan. As you move through this episode, we'll hear excerpts from the book, often talking about the specific characteristics, styles, and skills of some of those early rock and roll innovators. And then we'll talk about how those examples resonated or were later applied by Dylan. Our guest reader for this episode is Minnesota musician, author, and broadcaster Paul Metza. Paul has his own book about the recording of Blood on the Tracks coming out later this year, and you can find links to his work and more about him in the show notes. Chapter 3 and our conversation today ends with a discussion of how Bob Dylan contended with and reacted to and managed the process of being a rock star. Like everything else he did, as you'll hear, he took the smarter and road less traveled. The book we're discussing, Song and Dance Man, The Art of Bob Dylan, was first published 50 years ago. It was revised several times over the years and grew to over 900 pages. And it's just been put back in print. You can order Volume 1 of the 50th Anniversary Series at Amazon in paperback or on Kindle. Convenient links are in the show notes. Now, here's our discussion of Chapter 3 from Volume 1 of Song and Dance Man. All right, Michael, Chapter 3, after our forays into folk music and literature, Chapter 3 digs into rock and roll. The chapter starts with a bit of a history of rock and roll, and I think you're making a point about the world Dylan grew up in and the things he might have heard and so forth. Why don't you share with us a little summary, if you will, about that? Rock and roll, I think, came to mean something different to us all, maybe, than you're implying it meant, you know, at that moment in time.
Well, I think when Bob Dylan first heard rock and roll, it would have been in 1955 or six. I mean, that's when it arrived. I mean, you know, we know now that Elvis recorded That's All Right in July 54, and that Little Richard recorded Tutti Frutti in 55. But for most people, it certainly didn't arrive till 55. And I'm not sure that Elvis's That's All Right could really be called rock and roll anyway. I mean, no one knew what to call it at the time. This is one of the great things then, you know, that no one went into a studio, well, certainly no one young, went into a studio saying, I want to make, a radio smash or an adult-oriented rock sound. There were none of those categories, you know. There was kind of easy listening, light entertainment, horrible, horrible stuff, you know, crooners and all that lightweight jazz and so on. But anything that anyone young and in the sort of generation of Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly, anything they were doing, who knew what to call it? You know, there's an interview where Elvis is asked if what do you call that stuff? Is it bebop? Bebop. And Elvis says, well, I guess, you know, nobody knew. In other words, the whole thing was completely wide open. The first time that anyone started trying to put DJs into a box and tell them what they had to play was in 57 in the States. But, you know, when all this erupted in the mid-50s, there were 6,000 independent radio stations in the USA. And you know, some of them had very local audiences only, like I guess the ones that Elvis first was played on in Memphis. And others had huge, powerful speakers so that Bob Dylan up in Minnesota could apparently listen to a station coming from Texas. So, you know, God knows what he heard, but we know some of what he heard. But yeah, I mean, rock and roll became pop and pop became rock music. That's the very general way things happened, you know, from an explosive start where all the grown-ups were saying, this is disgusting music and it just breeds street violence and teddy boys and punks and so on. Those things were really raw 2.5-minute records by very young people, not always men. You know, Vander Jackson, for example, belted out, let's have a party. Brenda Lee was pretty good as well when she was very, very young. And I think she started at 14. That was a sort of tut, tut, let's try and ban this stuff. That was the response that got. And so gradually by the end of the 50s, that had been squeezed off the airways more or less completely. In terms of radio anyway, and radio was the only thing that mattered apart from actual record sales. And it was radio that allowed people to hear what records they wanted to buy. So by 1960, it was a lot prettier and softer. And it was just, you know, pretty boys, Bobby V. A lot of them were called Bobby and Johnny. And they were just, you know, singing stuff with pizzicato strings behind them, and it was different. It was safe. It was okay to have on the radio. And in Britain, it was particularly welcome that you could have British cover versions of these American records. When I say welcome, I only mean by the BBC, which had a monopoly on who could hear what, because certainly no sane teenager wanted to hear Cilla Black singing You've Lost That Loving Feeling when they could hear the Righteous Brothers. But that's how it was. And then out of that pop music, as people grew up and the 60s exploded and everything went druggy and liberated and open, then pop music became rock music. And there was certainly a point in the early 70s when records by people from the mid-50s, people like Fats Domino, that felt far more passé and old-fashioned by about 1970, even though it was only from 15 years earlier. Far more passé and let's not admit that we ever bought far more like that than now when, you know, thank God we're allowed to like anybody, however old their records.
Going back to the 1960 timeframe, because it's interesting, and I think something I'll talk about later, you know, Bob sits conveniently or well in a lot of timelines. So as you just described, he got to hear that mid-50s explosion and the raw versions before it got, you know, cleaned up.
Yes.
And in fact, in the book, after that introduction, you will listen to our first passage, which is something you say about Bob right at that time.
At this point, enter Bob Dylan. Sometime the previous year, he'd been playing harmonica in a Central City, Colorado strip joint, and in December 1960, reached New York City, guitar at the ready, and still listening to everything. By this time, too, he must have soaked up all the cumulative residue of skills in lyric writing, as well as in music, of Presley, Chuck Berry, and Domino.
So this sets the stage for the bulk of this chapter when you, like you did with folk and literature, kind of cite specific examples and look at what Bob took from different folks.
There's something a little bit misleading in that passage, in that, you know, it sort of implies that Presley wrote material too, which he didn't. But that aside, it seemed to me, you know, I mean, the thing is, a lot of this chapter is inspired by my own remembering how it felt to be 13 or 15 and latching onto all this stuff. You know, there's quite a few paragraphs in this where I talk about feeling loyalty towards people, feeling protective towards these young rock and rollers. And, you know, obviously that's an attitude that you grow out of. You replace it with a more mature appreciation of their work. But it was certainly there, you know. You know, in the same way, at that point, I absolutely loved Fats Domino, for example. And one of the things I really loved about him was the way he pronounced things and could rhyme things. You know, he rhymes the word man with the word ashamed, for example, in one of his songs. You know, now, obviously, he has a very New Orleans accent, and I didn't know much about different regional American accents at the time. But certainly, there was something particularly rock and roll, something particularly young and modern about the way that these people messed about with the English language in their pronunciation and in their rhyming, like that Buddy Holly bit about somebody wants you to do the car. Somebody else says, what do you want it for? It's something that the older records didn't do, you know. People before rock and roll, vocalists were supposed to sing as clearly as possible and to enunciate precisely, you know, and that's one of the things that makes most of them sound laughable now, because it's so formal. It's so, you know, pull your finger out and get real, you know?
Also, as Dylan shows more than anyone, it takes a tool out of the communication arsenal. It makes it neutral all the time.
Yes, that's a really nice phrase, actually, that you've used there. It does take a tool out of the arsenal. And it's one of the tools that Bob Dylan has pioneered more than anyone. But, you know, what I'm saying here is that it wasn't just people like me who relished the way Fats Domino or Little Richard or any of these people pronounced things and rhymed things, but I'm quite sure Bob Dylan, young Bob Dylan up in Minnesota, must have loved that too, because, you know, for him as well, all ears, it was part of the antidote to school. It was part of the antidote to, I don't know, the locked-in traditional family that he was part of.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a section of the book, of this chapter, chapter 3, where you specifically talk about Fats Domino and what Bob might have taken from him.
What Dylan did gain from the years up to 59 were lessons learned from Fats Domino and Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly, relatively specific things from highly distinctive artists. Fats Domino taught white pop fans about idiosyncratic flexibility in lyrics, particularly in rhymes, through odd emphasis, a Dylan trick, and odd pronunciation. In Domino's good-hearted man, he manages by his accent and his disregard for consonants to make the word man rhyme with a shame. No mean feat.
Yes. The way he rhymes half-sick and traffic is an example that he's taken from those people, you know. It's a great thing that he does with words, obviously. People talk so predominantly about the words he uses. People talk less about the way he pronounces them and forces them to rhyme if he wants to.
You know, the most dramatic ones get a lot of attention, but there's so many subtle, you know, orphanages and things like that people go on about, but there's a thousand more little
absolutely,
twists.
Yeah. The most spectacular one really is rhyming is in Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, I think, where he rhymes January with Buenos Aires.
Yeah. Oh, and it's fantastic.
And he completely pulls it off too. I mean, it's just marvelous.
Yeah. And that, I think the fun thing about this chapter and them all in their own way is connecting that back and saying, hey, look, there was this guy, Fats Domino, who he would have heard at the perfect time, you know, a few years before this, and who did this. And again, as we talked about in the last chapter, it's not something Bob made up from whole cloth on his own.
Sure, of course. And also you have to remember that, you know, as part of what shows us how much attention he paid to all that rock and roll and took from it is the fact that, you know, he had an electric guitar before he sold it to go into folk music.
Well, it is another interesting thing relative to the simplistic view of Dylan that he started in folk and came out versus a more complex view where folk was an aberration for a short period of time or an opportunistic thing that was what was happening in the village. And so he played that game because that was the game that was being
played.
Well,
I don't think it was just opportunistic though. I mean, I think that if he was still listening to the radio in, you know, 59 and 60, he was hearing the soft, boring pop that had replaced rock and roll on the radio. He was hearing, you know, Send Me the Pillow You Dream On by Johnny Tillotson, that sort of stuff. And clearly for him, being a very bright guy, this was not enough. And when he heard, when people like John Pancake played him folk stuff up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, you know, he heard that there was far more in it than 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock rock, you know, as well as far more in it than Send Me the Pillow You Dream On.
Yeah, well, let's look. The chapter then goes on to another pre-1960 influence on Dylan, Chuck Berry. Let's listen to a few paragraphs you wrote about the two of them.
Dylan also took over Berry's manipulation of objects and the details and ad man phrases that surround them. There are plenty of equivalents of that cherry red 53 in Dylan's rock songs. Dylan doesn't go in for the masked place names Berry parades so generously, although there is one song less characteristic than just interesting, which crams in all of the following names. It's the unreleased wanted band: California, Buffalo, Kansas City, Ohio, Mississippi, Cheyenne, Colorado, Georgia by the Sea, El Paso, Juarez, Shreveport, Abilene, Albuquerque, Syracuse, Tallahassee, and Baton Rouge. It's also true that Dylan could never have written a song like Tombstone Blues without Chuck Berry, nor especially could Subterranean Homesick Blues have come into being without him, either in its musical format or its words. It needed Berry's Too Much Monkey Business first.
That one, that's a spectacular example. I mean, half of the Chuck Berry song sounds very plodding and old-fashioned, and has done for decades now. But the other bit, the bit where he lists all the awful tasks he has to do in his boring job, that's what Subterranean Homesick Blues takes and flies with, you know. I think, you know, if I can remember it, Chuck says, he's working in the filling station. Too many tasks. Wipe the windows, change the oil, fill the tank. Whatever. And Dylan expands this from having a tedious job to having a tedious life. You know, get born short, pants romance, learn to dance, all that. I mean, the one comes very directly from the other. And actually, the Berry song, I'm slightly unfair to that in thinking it's just about his job, because actually it isn't. There's more in the lyrics of the Berry song than that. But, you know, Dylan takes that and runs with it, and he runs brilliant way with Subterranean Homesick Blues. Yeah. But Berry, you know, Berry is an exceptional rock poet. The way he fits words and music together, he does it more straightforwardly than Bob. He doesn't have to manipulate the syllables so much. There's a great precision about the way that the words fit the music in Chuck Berry songs. Even when he comes out of prison in 64 and releases Nadine, it's just so beautifully constructed. Most people, if they went back and tried to make rock and roll records in the 60s, 63, 64, they were never nearly as good as they were in the 50s when they made them in the first place. But Chuck Berry was. Chuck Berry's Nadine is just brilliant, the way the words fit the music. As I got on the city bus and found a vacant seat, I thought I saw my future bride walking down the street. I shouted to the driver, "Hey, conductor, you must slow down. I got to see her. Please let me off this bus. Nadine, honey, is that you?"
I know Bob and Chuck met, but years ago, there weren't pairings made and there weren't performances. It seemed like those two could have had a nice show somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously Chuck put another 30 plus years in, so there was plenty of opportunity. Next, you go a little deeper into Elvis, either long before or at the time of the fantasy meeting in the little Minnesota town. But here's a passage about Elvis.
Presley's voice had nobility, a clear, charismatic rarity to which a generation rallied and felt uplifted in hoping to protect, just as another generation intensely desired to protect the man whose voice lit up, "I threw it all away." There are many other links between the two. In the first place, Dylan would have heard at least part of his old blues material secondhand through Presley. Elvis's Milk Cow Blues Boogie, which Dylan uses in "It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry," is from an old song by Kokomo Arnold, not a well-known name, I guess up in Minnesota, who was born in Lovejoy, Georgia in 1901. Also, Dylan's lyric and tune on "One More Night" are heavily reminiscent of Elvis's record, "Blue Moon of Kentucky." That's All Right, Presley's first record, is down there in the Bob Dylan songbook. The clear allusion to Floyd Kramer's piano style on the end of "Tell Me That It Isn't True" is an allusion to a style much associated with Elvis in his RCA Victor studios at Nashville.
Talk a little bit more about what Dylan took from Elvis Presley.
As the text says, Dylan would have heard some of the old blues that he did by listening to Elvis's reinterpretation of that material. I mean, for example, "That's All Right," Elvis's first single, recorded in 54. It's a revisit to an Arthur Big Boy Crudup record of 1949. So, you know, there's a sort of idea that still floats around sometimes that Elvis just ripped off black music. This is absolute nonsense. He played it because he loved it, you know. No one was playing Arthur Big Boy Crudup's "That's All Right" in 1954. It was a forgotten, fairly mediocre blues record from the previous decade. You know, Dylan wasn't, Elvis wasn't rushing out a cover version because he could sell more because he was white. He sang that song because he absolutely loved it. And he did a number of the others like that. And he did several of Crudup songs, and a lot of those old rock and roll records of Elvis's were based on old blues records that he'd loved and were not huge hits ever. for those original artists. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, Elvis's early work was a definite channel through to Bob Dylan. Everybody thinks of Elvis in different ways, I guess, but the lazy way to think of him is as the Las Vegas guy who just gets lost in every way. But when Elvis is young, Elvis is absolutely charismatic, and his voice is beautiful. He has some of his early sides have a beautiful, authentic hillbilly sort of keening sound to them. You know, he kind of drops his voice later as Lieber and Stoller start writing all his material, and he becomes kind of typecast as the guy who sings, you know, and the records, as he becomes more and more typecast, the records get more and more feeble. You know, when he comes out of the army in 1960 and releases the first post-army single, Stuck on You, it's just another old record, you know. It's not exciting. And so by 62, when he's recording things like Good Luck Charm and One Broken Heart for Sale and starting to make these terrible films, long before the Las Vegas years, he's already become a puppet, you know, for the worst kind of lowest common denominator audience that Colonel Parker can seek out. So he's gone, you know, and there's the world of difference between the Bob Dylan who arrives in the early 60s and the Elvis who is drowning in the early 60s.
But once again, Bob's formative years were just at the right time to soak up the best parts of
Elvis Presley. Yeah. And actually, there's a quote from him somewhere where he says that Susie Rotolo is the only one who knows that in 62, I was listening to those Elvis Presley singles.
The early ones, you mean?
I don't know. I'm not sure he does mean the early ones. I think like me in 1960, 61, 62, I suspect that he's still hoping for something decent from Elvis Presley.
Let's move on to another name associated in a strange way, but a significant way with Bob Dylan, Buddy Holly. And here's a couple paragraphs from chapter 3.
Controlling Holly was a special thing, tantamount to integrity, a precision demanded by artistic considerations, which was one of the things that made for his greatness. Dylan learned a lot about such considerations, I would say, directly from Buddy Holly. There are times when both of them appear not to have this control, times when bits of phrasing sound at first hearing like bad mistakes, but they never are. The wild swoop hiccup at the end of the title phrase in Holly's Tell Me How is an example. Dylan provides others in the times they are a-changin', and among others, Drifter's Escape. The oddities are not mistakes. They're far more right than the expected alternatives that don't appear. A few more playings, and they both prove their points. The control and precision were perfect after all. And when that realization dawns, both artists have taught you something.
That's very nice.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, times they are changing. The way he sings that changing, you know, to any conventional radio listener who at the time was hearing Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra and yet at the same time, I don't know, the Kenny Ball jazz band and so on and so on, all kinds of stuff. You know, the way Dylan sings the times they are a-changing, it's too fast, you know, it should be changing. And he never does sing it like that because, of course, you know, he's better than that. That's all I mean, really. Greil Marcus had had a good piece one time when he was still writing for underground papers like the San Francisco Express Times, or maybe early Rolling Stone, where he envisages how it would have been if Holly had lived and he and Dylan would have done concerts together and duetted. And I love that. Yeah. They would have been much happier together than Bob was with Paul Simon doing duets.
Well, Greil on his new Substack is reposting many of his old pieces. Maybe I'll drop him a note and see if he can pick up that one and include it to refresh our memories of that.
Yeah, that would be nice.
So in this chapter, I should let people know that you go through, there's several pages of each of these on Buddy Holly and Elvis Presley and Fats Domino and in each of these. So it's a really in-depth kind of a closer reading or more details about the career and Dylan's relationship. So it's we're just sampling it here. But then as the chapter starts to wind down, there's a section I find very interesting, which is talking about Dylan and fame. And you make the distinction between a pop star, and a rock star and the celebrity. Dylan obviously very quickly occupied a space that only Presley and the Beatles and, you know, a few others had done. And this word rock, you know, rock starts as, you know, Costello makes a big deal of when the Rock was left alone without the role, as a very negative connotation whenever he talks about it. Let's listen to a paragraph where you start talking about the implication of all this.
There's another aspect of Dylan worth dealing with in the context of the old pop as much as the new rock. That is not Dylan the artist, but Dylan the star. Dylan is the greatest rock and roll star in the world. Partly, of course, is because he's the best rock writer and singer and performer there has ever been, but partly, and the two aren't by any means totally distinguishable, it's because he's become an idol, a superstar. In the summer of 1978, a full 12 years after his 1960s cult zenith of popularity, and at a time when punk was at its height, Bob Dylan pulled 250,000 people to Black Bush for one concert, special trains, RAC routes, a lot.
One interesting thing is whether that's another thing Bob learned. I mean, there's that it happened to Bob and Bob had to deal with it. But Bob also, as we just enumerated one at a time, Bob had paid attention to a bunch of folks who got extremely popular, Chuck Berry and the rest of the list. And so had maybe thought about it a little bit. And, you know, I'm not sure anyone's prepared for what happened to him, but it wasn't a foreign idea. And he knew, presumably, that was part of the job.
Yeah. On the other hand, you know, sounds quaint now to call him the greatest rock star of all time, because quite clearly there are many people who have far and away outsold him in record sales and who are more famous to a wider general public than Bob is, and so on. But that at that moment, yeah, 1978, you know, old hippies, people like Bob and me were labeled as such, whether we'd ever been hippies or not. We were supposed to be lined up against the wall and shot by the mood of punk, you know? The Sex Pistols, the Stranglers, the Clash, Buzzcocks. Those were people, those were groovy. Those were people who were telling it like it is. You know, it was all black plastic bags and pins through your nose, and, you know, because this was gritty and real. And Bob Dylan was this, you know, relic. I mean, you know, he was over 30 years old for a start. And yet, for the 6 nights he did at Earl's Court in London, which is a many, many thousand-seater hall, you had to queue all night to buy tickets. There was no, thank God, there was no Ticketmaster then. If you wanted to go, you had to queue, stand in line. He was so big in 78 that people did that. And then at the end of those six nights, yeah, Blackbush Aerodrome was somewhere down south of London. And the whole British railway system laid on special trains to get people to this aerodrome for this 3-hour performance that he gave. I mean, there were other people on the bill. There was Joan Armatrading, Graham Taylor, and Eric Clapton. That's because it was a bit like a sort of festival, but it was all one day. But, you know, those people wouldn't have drawn all that stuff to an aerodrome. It was Bob. And that was one of the times he wore the top hat, by the way, that we see again on the cover of my book. The other thing about this is that that he's always been through phases of being hot and phases of being passé. In the early 70s, he'd done nothing. He was nobody. And, you know, the last album had been Self-Portrait. And then there's another period a bit later on where he does Blood on the Tracks. And suddenly it's a game-changing thing because it's a proof that you can make great albums at any age. And there's a prospect that you can maybe carry on making them for decades to come, that you're not confined to the 1960s after all. And then, of course, he throws all that away, deliberately or not, when he becomes born again. And then he comes out of that and has an interesting heart disease. And everybody decides that he's important again after all. And he releases Time Out of Mind, you know. It's a very circular business with Bob, but he certainly proved to be in it for the long term.
And the way he manages that is, of course, interesting in its own light. I mean, in the book, you talk a little bit about this idea of cultivating scarcity, I would call it, which is something that is long gone now.
Yes.
Out of desperation. Let's look at something you say in the book, and then we can, I think it is interesting to talk about the way the world is now, both as in terms of how Bob has adapted and how a young Bob might fare in a world like today.
You wouldn't catch Dylan on Top of the Pops or In Bed for Peace or on The Parkinson Show. His scarcity value is enormous. Rumors about what he's doing are whispered around now and then. He limits himself effectively to albums and never brings out more than one a year. When California was bursting with supposedly incredible rock groups and crowded out with every pace-setting beautiful person in the world, Dylan remained pointedly 3,000 miles away in splendid isolation in New York State. Involvement is death, he once wrote. It sounds easy. Refuse to appear for 50 pounds and eventually some will offer you 500 pounds. Do that once, throwing in a little controversy while you're at it, and then start refusing again. Easy or not, most people don't manage it. Most people don't appear to even understand. It's true that much of Dylan's uncooperation with the media is in response to their intrusions, their attempts to raise a man who is great and a serious artist to their own level of vulgarity on the journalistic Peter principle, but it also comes from Dylan's shrewdness as an image builder, a garble in rock music.
So that was very effective then, and he was clearly the master.
Yeah. Very different now, yeah, very different. I think, you know, he's, I think what changed was, well, I think a number of things changed. Obviously, television took over from radio, and Dylan had the instinctive sense to keep away from television as much as possible because it diminishes you, you know. If you're always on the small screen, this was before the internet. If you're always on the small screen, then, you know, you're not a superstar. You're not unattainable. You're not God. So that was the first thing that he did in the kind of newer era beyond radio. And with record companies, yes. I mean, the only time he's ever really kowtowed to what the marketing people wanted was with the MTV Unplugged thing in the mid-90s, when he should have been performing properly unplugged and doing the material from his two unplugged 1990s albums, Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong. But anyway, but you know, that was very, it's significant that that was very uncharacteristic of him to kowtow to that sort of MTV executive demand for the big hits. And, you know, well, no, we don't want that old stuff. We want Like a Rolling Stone and Forever Young and all the rest of it. But of course, beyond that, when the internet arrives, there was a time early on, I think, when Bob said some sort of anti-computer remark or another.
It wasn't only the 60s, right? Because even, you know, Prince did it through the 80s and 90s and sort of did that. You know, there's very few Prince interviews and Prince appearances and Prince things. Yes. And if you're, you know, at the end, it seems like if your music is actually good enough to pull people, you don't have to do the other stuff.
And I think that's a great point. I think that's true, that if the music is good enough, you don't have to do all that other stuff. On the other hand, you can cater to it. I mean, the official bootleg series, whatever else it is a spin-off from unofficial bootlegs, right? It's a response to the way in which Bob Dylan was properly bootlegged so many, many times over.
It, beyond the scope of this, but it's very interesting how all the things, you know, even what you talked about in terms of the website, right? All of the Bill Pagels and the Olafs who did this stuff in the underground for years, A, they served Bob very well by, yes, by facilitating the hardcore folks who had a lot to do with his,
sure,
life. And then it was smart to, I don't, you know, Dylan wasn't the first, right? I think Zappa was the first who repackaged bootlegs and a box of boots or whatever he did first. You know, the point is the world changed and they had to respond to it. But our friend Mitch Blank has said to me, you know, I used to be the asshole, meaning collecting and grabbing and holding everything. It was not cool when he did it for decades. And now he's revered and separated and on the payroll. In fact, you know, he works obviously for the Bob Dylan Center and just made a fabulous donation to them. You know, the times, yeah, are changing.
Yeah.
I actually want to go back in a minute to what we talked about in folk and lit and then rock, because these three chapters together really kind of document a bit of Dylan's formal education. And as you say, he took all these things. He was smart enough to recognize them, to notice them. He didn't just spit them back out. Added value, to use modern parlance to it, and made something new, you know, made something new with something old, which he almost does more near the end of his career and defends harder while not being ashamed of the borrowing part of it at all. But here's a few short paragraphs from the very end of the chapter.
Despite the influence of Hawley, Presley, Berry, and the rest, Dylan's work is far more original than derivative. He's been the big influence. He created the rebirth in rock. Dylan goes beyond other people. With every new album, there's progression. And this has happened so fast that in one sense, Dylan has always been an outsider in pop, has always been ahead of his time.
So first of all, we should say that I would guess those paragraphs are from the first edition, meaning you wrote those relatively early on. So that was, I mean, yes, that was from the point of view of an early 70s young writer. How do you feel about them now?
Well, I think it was true for a while. It was true crucially early on. And I think it's still true that he's outside of the industry. You know, he's like a separate industry. But obviously there are other ways in which he has become more traditional and less radical. That's very clear. I like the way that on Rough and Rowdy Ways, he says, you know, outright, I'm not what I was. Things aren't what they were. No one else says that, really, do they? Most people claim that they're as good as they've ever been. So Bob is still out there on his own, really, outside of the rules of what your publicist would like you to be saying.
So let's reflect for a minute on, as I said, these three chapters, this kind of trinity of influence of folk music, literature, and rock and roll. You know, as we said a little bit earlier, the timing is kind of perfect. The folk boom is happening right when he arrives in Greenwich Village. You know, he learned the old school lit in school, but now Kerouac and Ginsberg are right before him, sort of throwing up flares. As we went through today, rock music had this initial burst during his formative years, and then a set of changes are about to happen. Really, if you're writing the script for the movie of all of these things happening, and then you want to plop this guy in 1961, 2, 3, and say, okay, build on it.
Yeah.
Go somewhere new. There's something to be said for timing.
Oh, absolutely. I think, in the micro and the macro sense, Bob Dylan has always had fabulous timing. He's always been very lucky too. You know, he's lucky to still be alive. When you think what he's lived through and how many people he has known who have dropped dead all around him down the years, he's had a great deal of luck. Bob Dylan has been very lucky in terms of his career and in terms of, the respect that he has earned left, right, and center. On the other hand, I don't know, and I don't ever try to know anything about the personal tragedies and losses of love that he has suffered as an individual human being. That's a different matter, and that's not my business. And to the extent that he wants to tell us about that stuff, he can do it in songs. And whether we take it as autobiographical or not, that's nothing to do with him either. That's to do with us.
Way, if you will, or comparatively talk about with the long view back now, how folk literature and rock have influenced Bob.
I think it was a fabulous combination, the folk, the literature, and the rock and roll. You know, everyone could hear that stuff, but no one else did what Bob Dylan did with it. Everyone could read books by the literary greats and go to a folk club and buy a rock and roll record. But who else fused them together and recreated the world of song? Only Bob Dylan.
Perfect ending.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.